This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Filmmaker Greg Pak's first feature-length movie, Robot Stories, has been described as a work about love, death, and robots. It's an anthology of four stories of people in the immediate future interacting with technology that's almost human. Greg Pak grew up in Dallas, Texas, in a Korean-American family. He came to filmmaking after studying political science at Yale and history as a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford. His previous work includes a series of short films, including a documentary about his Korean grandfather called Fighting Grandpa. Besides writing screenplays and producing his own films, Greg Pak runs several websites, including one on Asian film, and has even dabbled in Texas politics. Pak got Robot Stories noticed one audience at a time, taking it to more than 50 film festivals, building a following, and winning awards, 29 in all. Let's begin with a clip from Robot Stories. A couple, played by Tamlin Tamita and James Saito, are at an agency preparing to adopt a baby. But when the white-coated staff present the bundle of joy, it turns out to be a robot swaddled in a baby blanket. The staff is explaining how to care for the electronic infant.
This is the bottle. It's actually a recharging unit for his batteries.
Oh.
The tip fits right there. You'll know he's full when it starts to beep.
So how often do we need to feed
him? Every 3 hours or so. He'll let you know when he's hungry.
What else do we need to do? Feed him, keep him warm?
We rig him to leak a little graphite after feedings. Wipe him off or he'll bust out crying.
Sounds pretty manageable.
Well, there's a little more to it than that. He has the G9 processor, which means he'll learn and grow. He'll become his own little person, based largely on his experiences with you. So you want to treat Bobby the way you would a human baby. Hold him, talk to him, play with him. In short, love him. His hard drive will record all of the nurturing you give, so when we download at the end of the month, we'll be able to see how well you cared for him. And then we'll see what we can do about getting you a real baby.
Greg Pak, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much. Very happy to be here.
Now, where did this idea come from, of a parent training robot?
You know, I grew up in Dallas, Texas, and in middle school, all the kids in health class at a certain point had to carry around baskets, and in those baskets were little eggs, and they had to see how long they could go without breaking the egg. And, it's one of those don't get pregnant kids cautionary exercises, I think. But that always stuck with me, this notion of an egg that you had to take care of. So, I don't know, for some reason that robot baby always was going to be egg-shaped for me. I think it was also inspired in some way by the Tamagotchi craze, if you remember that. It was a little electronic toy that kids had to take care of, and if, you know, they had to feed it periodically, and if they didn't take care of it, it would die, and small children would burst into tears in kindergarten and everything. But yeah, it's funny because I remember when my dad read the screenplay, he said, you better make this pretty quick because somebody's going to do that.
It struck me, and I think it's going to strike a lot of people, as maybe not a terrible idea. I mean, a lot of people say that people ought to have licenses to be parents.
You know, the crazy thing is actually a friend sent me a link recently, and apparently there is some school in Australia, I think, that has built a robot. They've got a baby doll with electronics in it that can tell when it's being held improperly and stuff like that. So it's actually, you know, a few steps away from actually coming true.
Well, it's interesting that, I mean, I think this is a very compelling tale, and it's interesting to me that the baby robot here looks nothing at all like a human baby. It looks like, I guess, about a 2-foot-long Easter egg with big dopey eyes and kind of 1950s-looking robotic movements.
Yep.
I know that you didn't have a big budget for this film, but you certainly could have gotten a more human-looking, like, robot to play the parent-training robot here. Why did you choose that kind of an image?
You know, it was a conscious choice because my thought was that the agency would want to give these parents something that's alien, something that's a little strange, because most of the time I think people immediately bond with their child. You know, they just love this child irrationally and devotedly and, without hesitation. But there are also parents who don't quite feel that connection with their baby. And I think that would be something that when, you know, if there were an adoption agency that wanted to test for that kind of a thing, I think they would be smart to give people a baby that's not quite so cute. You know what I mean? If you're going to give somebody a robot baby to take care of to see if they're going to be good parents, if you give them an incredibly bondable little robot, something that's immediately charming and wonderful, then it may not be as good a test as if you give somebody something that's a little strange, you know, a little scary. I remember also, I mean, that story was also inspired by just talking to my mom at different points. I remember once, when I was a kid, my little sister, you know, I remember playing with my little sister and giving her a frog that I'd caught. And she just, you know, she was like 2 years old or 3 years old and she didn't know. And she just squeezed it and killed it. And I was kind of horrified. And I remember years later talking to my mom about that. And she said, you know, every child looks like a monster sometimes. And that actually ended up being a line in the robot baby story. But I think that's part of it too. It's just this notion that, that things are never perfect, you know what I mean? And that we all have these sort of moments of horror or moments of failure or frailty.
You know, I'm a big lover of science fiction, and I think great science fiction is really about human beings encountering a strange world or forces that are outside of human experience. Yeah. And I think this film really is all about that. I mean, it's not It's interaction with technology, but it's not on an epic scale. I mean, nobody gets killed by a plasma death ray.
yeah, our catchphrase for that is things don't blow up. A sci-fi fan told me that. I was trying to explain the film to him, and he nodded and he said, "Oh yeah, things don't blow up. That's cool. He could go with that."
Did you decide you wanted to kind of explore this human technological interaction in kind of a smaller way?
When I was thinking about making my first feature film as an independent filmmaker, these stories were things that had sort of come into my head over the years. And so while I was writing them, I was thinking about budget. Each one of the stories has one sort of crazy element in it. You know, we had to build the robot baby. We had to figure out how to make people look like androids. You know, we had to have this kind of digital breakup effect in the last story with the virtual world that's being depicted. But each one of those small, you know, challenges was totally surmountable given the budget we had. And then, you know, the notion of having science fiction and this kind of emotional human storytelling put together, I mean, that's something that I guess I didn't really think about that just because that was sort of second nature to me when I was writing these. And the fact that we didn't have much money, I think, actually really worked with that, you know, because it made us really concentrate on nailing that emotional story. I didn't have the money to get to spend, you know, 3/4 of the day trying to, you know, make the 10-foot-tall giant robot crash through the streets of Manhattan, you know.
Like so, is that in your folder, the plasma death ray machine is when you get a big budget?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I actually, there was a fifth robot story, which I outlined, and I was really sort of excited about it, and it did involve a 10-foot-tall robot, you know, crashing through the streets of Manhattan. But alas, that was not to be. You know, most robot movies are essentially Frankenstein movies. They're cautionary tales about technology gone awry. I mean, they're basically, original sin sort of fall of man stories about, forbidden knowledge and the fact that, you know, the notion that we will be destroyed by trying to assume God's prerogative, really, as creators.
Well, it's interesting because it seems to me that the closest we get to that in yours is the last one in which it concerns a world in which people, as they approach death, upload their consciousness into a mm-hmm. computer and, in effect, granting them kind of a digital eternal life. And right. The central character is an old artist confronting his death, and his son and his friends are saying, "Dad, it's time to upload," and he resists it. Was this sort of a cautionary tale, I mean, about where science could take us?
I think, you know, it's interesting because people use the term cautionary tale a lot. And I think certainly it is that. I wasn't necessarily thinking of it as a cautionary tale when I was writing it. I think I was thinking more of this notion that this will actually be something that we very well may have to confront in the next, say, 50 to 100 years. This notion of that we may be able to shift our consciousness into machines, basically, and have it endure forever. And so at a certain point, we're going to have to decide whether or not that's something we really want to do. You know, I think it is a genuine, clearly by the end of it, the artist makes a decision and goes, you know, and makes a choice. And so the film, you know, implies, probably gives the implication that one choice is superior to another. But at the same time, I think that, you know, there's a lot to be said for the other side, you know, and the film doesn't necessarily try to paint the other side as sheer villainy. I think when folks watch the movie, they bring a lot of themselves to it. And, you know, when folks, you know, some folks are, you know, very attracted to sort of both sides of the argument. The other side of the argument is represented by his wife, who died as a young woman and was scanned and lives in this digital world, has sort of achieved this kind of perfect serenity. You know, it's a very optimistic view of what this kind of experience would create. The idea is that once you get scanned, your consciousness can interact with the sum total of all human knowledge. With everybody else who has ever been scanned, you can sort of instantly tap into that. And it's sort of like instant access to the infinite. And it assumes that, you know, once you're able to do that, you you achieve this kind of nirvana, this peace. Like I say, it's that may or may not happen. Maybe it would just drive you insane. But anyway, but her state is, you know, some people may admire that, or some people may think that's something to be, you know, that would be something to strive for. The artist, though, I mean, his struggle is that he doesn't feel like he deserves that kind of peace and that kind of perfection without having earned it. You know, which is a sort of a more organic, I guess, way to think about it.
Right.
One of the things that struck me as I watched the film was the remarkable sounds, the sounds that you gave the robots. Did that require a lot of thought? Did you have any particular approach there?
Oh, yeah. I had a great sound designer named Nelson Nudd, who, you know, this was like his second project. And he's, yeah, Nelson and I just recorded all kinds of different electronic sounds. I recorded every single like hard drive I had in my office and home, and the CD player and my iPod and all these kind of things.
So a lot of it, it struck me that a lot of it will be very familiar to people who use Windows or computer, you know. We were trying to sort of bridge the technology of today to the technology of the future there.
I love the fact that there are familiar sounds in there. I mean, like the sound of a hard drive. We hear that every day, our hard drive spinning up and spinning down, but we don't think about it. And in the movie, the hard drive spinning up and spinning down, the character I play, Archie, he's this android who is programmed to interact with people so that he can fit in well with the office. He, you know, he's programmed to be very friendly and to learn how people want him to behave in the office, but nobody wants to interact with him. So he kind of has his crisis moment as a result. He can't fulfill his programming. He can't connect. But whenever Archie is, you know, whenever somebody is nice to Archie, you hear his hard drive spin up, you know, and whenever somebody's mean to him, you hear it spin down, you know. And I just kind of like that, using those sort of very familiar sounds, giving them emotional context.
Well, I'm glad you brought up Archie, because that's the role that you play. Very convincingly. I mean, you're a guy who's trained to be an office worker, literally walks himself in someday and says things like, "I look forward to our interactions." How did you prepare yourself to be a robot?
You know, when I was writing that particular screenplay, I just kind of felt Archie. You know what I mean? I'd acted for years, mainly doing improv comedy in New York City, but I just hadn't put myself into that many things because I wanted to really know that I could nail it and just really feel it before I cast myself in something. But so, you know, first off, I just felt like I got Archie, just on an emotional level. You know, I mean, I think anybody who's ever felt, you know, sort of out on the outside.
He's a machine, you know, Greg. How can you get him on an emotional level?
I'm a geek. You know what I mean? And all of us geeks, we have our moments of our frontier moments of sadness and isolation, you know, so I can relate to Archie.
You kind of had to show emotional development with these sort of fixed eyes. I mean, that had to be an interesting challenge.
Yeah. I mean, I loved it actually, because it's like what we ended up, and I worked a lot with Julianne Henselka Kim, who plays the other robot, the female android, and also with Bill Kolias, who is great actor and just an amazing guy, who played the office worker who's responsible for Archie. He plays the tech guy in the office. And just in talking with both of them, you know, and just working on it, we kind of figured out some ground rules. And some of those ground rules involved all of them involved limitations. You know, and it was the idea that these robots wouldn't be as flexible as humans. They wouldn't be as mobile. That every single movement that they did would be thought through. You know, 99% of the things that I do every day, just physically, I don't think about. You know what I mean? It's like, I scratch my head, I don't think about it. I don't think about how each of my fingers works when I'm picking up a piece of paper or a pencil. I don't, you know, there's a million small movements that I make that I never think about. But when I was playing Archie, I thought about, you know, like, Archie had to consciously choose every single motion he made. And that was hugely helpful, you know. It means that you limit the number of motions you make, but then when you do make a motion, it has intention to it.
My guest is director Greg Pak. His film Robot Stories is being released across the country. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're back with film director Greg Pak. His new film is Robot Stories. Most of the characters in the film are Asian American, though the film is shot entirely in English and appears to be set in the United States. Do you see anything particularly Asian in the themes or appeal of Robot Stories?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I'm biracial. I'm half Korean and half white, and I grew up... I grew up in a mixed race household and biculturally, I guess, if you want to put it that way. But I always saw these characters as Asian or as mixed race. It kind of reflects the world in which I live. It's sort of genuinely multiculturally cast with, you know, white, black, Asian actors of all sort of colors and creeds. I think there are a couple of sort of reasons for that. I mean, one is just personal. You know what I mean? It's like Scorsese, you know, makes a lot of movies with Italian Americans in them. Woody Allen makes a lot of movies with Jewish people in them. You know, Brothers McMullen, made by an Irish American, has a lot of Irish Americans in it. And we all accept that. And I think I want to live in a world where we can all accept the same sort of the same thing from an Asian American director. Why not?
Right.
I purposefully cast the two robots, for example, with mixed race actors. Both Julian Henselka Kim and I are both half Korean. And I did that because I think that when they actually make robots that look like people, they're going to make them racially ambiguous because they're going to try to sell them in many different markets. We already see that kind of in sort of artificially created characters. Like in Japanese animation, the characters are all very racially ambiguous. And, you know, they're sort of intended for this international market.
You always loved film and TV, but then you go off and you study political science at Yale. You study history at Oxford. Did you always think you wanted to get back to film or television, or were you going to be an academic?
Well, you know, the first thing I ever thought that I was going to be is a writer. You know, from the age of 9 or 10, I was writing short stories and stuff like that, and that was what I thought of myself as. I was also drawing cartoons and doing black and white photography and, and acting and stuff. But all of that stuff at a certain point, you know, in my head, became extracurricular. You know, I kept doing that all the way through. I mean, I did improv comedy all the time, and even stand-up, actually, during all the time I was working in politics. But there was some part of me that didn't let myself think of that as real work, you know? I grew up as a, you know, mixed race kid in Dallas, Texas, and loved the people I grew up with, but at the same time was very aware of racial justice from a very young age. It's funny, I can, you know,
What do you mean by that? Did you suffer discrimination?
Yeah, I don't want to make too much of this because, like, every kid, like, probably, you know, like, a fat kid would have more trouble than I did as a mixed race kid. But I remember, you know, like, you know, from time to time, I'd have these bad experiences with racist kids I didn't know, almost always. But, I can remember being a Cub Scout and walking home from the bus stop and seeing another group of Cub Scouts in the park. And I went over the park and I was like, hi, you know, I wanted to say, hi, I'm a Cub Scout too, and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, they did the Chinese-Japanese dirty knees thing where they pull their eyes and chant. And I remember... It's funny because I don't remember being sad. I don't remember crying. I just remember being angry, you know, mm-hmm. because I was a Cub Scout and I knew what this country was founded on, you know, and I had this, I mean, it's kind of, I crack myself up when I think about that because at this very, very tender age, I had this huge amount of self-righteousness based on what I perceived as being the decent and strong and true principles of the country. So those kinds of issues were vitally important to me always. And I think that's one of the reasons why I was drawn to political science. My goal was to go back to Texas and work in politics, which I did. I went back home and worked for Ann Richards when she was running for office. But at the same time, at some point in there, I realized that something was missing, you know. The work I was doing was really important. But at the same time, on some level, I knew that there were probably 100,000 people out there who could be doing the same kind of stuff I was doing in that context.
Was it hard to then decide I'm going to let go of the serious career and do the thing that seemed like extra stuff?
You know, I at a certain point, it just made sense. I mean, I got a scholarship to go to Oxford, and I was there for 2 years, and I was studying history, which was great because regardless of what I was doing, my ostensible reason for going was because studying history would make me a better politician because I hadn't had a very good background in history. And frankly, studying history makes you better at anything that you do. So I loved that program, but while I was there, I had the chance for the first time to get involved with filmmaking. And as soon as I started doing it, it just clicked. You know, I mean, I knew it was what I needed to do. I made a short film at Oxford called Lonely Street, which none shall ever see. But you know, even in that little short film, it was kind of interesting because it started off as just a kind of a film noir spoof or homage. But we cast it with a woman, you know, and it had this kind of, it was like this British female film noir, which was a detective story, basically. You know, so even at that stage, I was kind of thinking, I mean, I kind of knew that movies in particular had this amazing potential to put different kinds of images up there, you know? It's like it's, if that's your only motivation, if your only motivation for making films is to sort of like, fight the man, then you're probably going to make a lot of really bad movies, you know what I'm saying? Because people don't want to go see polemic films. That's not why people go to the movies. You know, and so I was always driven by this, I had this emotional response to movies. I wanted to tell stories that were compelling to me on a human level, and that's what I've continued to do. But at the same time, the things that motivated me to go into politics remain things that are important to me in filmmaking. And having the chance to put different faces up on screen means that in filmmaking, it means that you give people an opportunity to identify with, bond with, fall in love with people from totally different backgrounds.
Well, Greg Pak, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Filmmaker Greg Pak, his first feature film, Robot Stories, is opening in cities across the country over the next few weeks. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.